Okay, great. Can everyone find the sheet in the sheer the sheet in the chat? So there. So what you'll be noticing is it doesn't say Rav Moshe Sternbach. It doesn't say Tshuva and Hagos. But actually, we're not done with Rav Moshe Sternbach yet. But I wanted to talk about Purim this week because, well, it doesn't hurt to be a little bit more relevant, right? So when I was looking up for our next posek who we're going to go through, Rav Nachum Rabinovich, I actually stumbled upon two tshuvos from him that I think are relevant to Purim. So Rabbi Cohen already talked about the significance of Purim this year. That was a whole separate shiur. So I wanted to really just maybe hit on two different angles that aren't related to Purim in the year of COVID or Purim in our weird schedule this year. Rabbi Cohen dealt with all that already. I just want to pick two different topics that Rav Nachum Rabinovich addresses. Now, I'll try to give a more fuller biographic description of him when we, for formal purposes, start going through our series of tshuvos from Rav Nachum Rabinovich. But I want to just take a minute to explain a little bit of who he was, and that way we can appreciate who we will be learning from this evening. So Rav Nachum Rabinovich, if I remember correctly, he was born in Canada. He was a rabbi in Charleston, South Carolina for a good number of years. So if you look inside Siach Nachum, which are his tshuos I have with me here, I scanned a few pages and gave it to you. One of his questions that he deals with is, how do you spell Charleston in a ksuba document? I was looking through the table of contents and I'm like, that's the most random question, like nothing else that specific. But he was rabbi in Charleston, so that became a tshuva in the book. And most recently, he served as the Rosh Yeshiva of a Hezer Yeshiva in Israel. I think it was, I am blanking out on it right now. Birchas Moshe. It's known as Maale Adumim because that's where it is. Anyone ever been to Maale Adumim?
No, I had a cousin that lived there.
Okay, so it's a nice yeshuv. And their yeshiva, which is Birchas Moshe or Birkat Moshe, is probably how they pronounce it. He was a Rosh Yeshiva. So he was very big in terms of conversions in Israel. I think we brought in a rabbi from Tzohar in Israel, which was like this religious Zionist modern Orthodox alternative to the chief rabbinate. That's what they were trying to make. So if I remember correctly, Rav Nachum Rabinovich was a big player in that field. So some of his tshuvos that we look at will be very informed with his philosophy. God willing, later on in this dealing his tshuvos, we'll deal with some questions of conversions that he dealt with. We'll deal with some of his more philosophy that makes him stand out unique as a religious Zionist slash modern Orthodox rabbi. But for the time being, the few tshuvos we're going to look at, it won't show as clearly. But forget about the religious Zionism and the modern Orthodox, He was a world-class posek, a gadol hador, a huge scholar. So anything he writes for us, even if there's no ideological bent to it, Torah is Torah. So that's what we're here studying tonight. Now we're going to look at two tshuvos. One tshuva deals with the question of kavod beis hakneses, which is the honor that needs to be ascribed to a sanctuary, to a shul. And what happens when that conflicts with Purim? The other two we're going to look at, we're not going to delve so deeply into the topic, but he deals with the question of cross-dressing on Purim. If a woman wants to dress up as a male character from a TV show or vice versa, a man dress up as a woman, is that okay on Purim? And what in theory would be the issue? So before I jump right into this, I want to just ask you guys, before we jump into the Purim question, in general, in a shul, what are things that one is allowed to do in a shul, and what are things that someone halachically is not allowed to do in a shul? Let's start with what you're not allowed to do. What halachically are you not allowed to do inside a Beis HaKnesses? When I say shul, by the way, I don't mean like the lobby of our shul, our beautiful new lobby, if you haven't seen it yet. But what I mean is when you're inside the main sanctuary, when you're inside the chapel, the actual shul part, where the Sifrei Torah are. So what are examples of things that you think you're not allowed to do inside a shul?
Not supposed to talk.
Okay, so Phil is saying during davening, you're not supposed to talk. Very good. Decorum is important. What's another example of something you shouldn't? Ruth?
I.
Oh, I thought I saw you say something. My mistake.
You're not supposed to talk. And if you do talk, you know, don't say what you call, look out the Hebrew word, you know,
talk
about someone or whatever, you know. I don't know. I'll let everyone comment.
Okay, sure. All right, that's good as well. You're planning out your move here. Okay, Arthur.
Sleep.
Sleep? Oh, sleep.
Sleep, eat.
Oh, sleep. I thought you said slee, like, you know, roasting. I'm thinking of sucking.
No.
We're not that far.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So one thing that Arthur brings up, I see curse, show disrespect for the Torah. Oh, very good. So
to eat, and even technically, even to kiss kids, it is kind of.
Oh, very good. Very good. Okay, let's break down a few things here. So sleeping and eating are relatively the same category. So there's something called a base. This is important. There's in halacha a base hakneses and a base medrash. So many times they're one and the same thing. But a base medrash is a study hall, and a base hakneses is what we think of when we think of like the main sanctuary in Agudas Shalom. The main sanctuary, a base hakneses. We'll talk about a moment if maybe our main sanctuary doesn't have the status of a base hakneses, but a base hakneses, you're not allowed to eat or sleep in. A base medrash, a study hall, where if you are someone who spends your whole day learning Torah, you're allowed to take a power nap and you're allowed to eat while you're in the base medrash. Some Batei Midrash make up their own policies. Now, one of the questions, and then Marina, I'll just point out Marina's point. Marina said you're not supposed to kiss your child in the base, in the shul either. Now, why wouldn't you be allowed to do that? Marina, you want to explain the reason?
Because Sfarim is there, and it is
along those lines. It's showing a prior, basically, when we're in the shul, we're supposed to prioritize our affection for God and not show
not to show to everyone else. Yeah,
right. I mean, you know, well, okay, maybe you know, I guess we could compromise. You could kiss your kids, but not other people's spouses. I mean, it's we could draw the line there at the very least. So
definitely not children.
Definitely not children. Now, why would you say children? Definitely not.
You
were talking about your own child, by the way.
This is right. You're right. You're not supposed to kiss children.
Your own child. Like,
yeah.
Like a kiss on the head.
Right. No, you don't kiss kids in shul.
Why?
It's something to do with that. You are putting them above Hashem, or Hashem is the one that you...
Okay, very good, Phyllis. Yes, that is the reasoning. The reasoning is that when we're in shul, we shouldn't be showing extreme affection for others. Our attention should be directed toward God. That's the idea. Okay, so now we mentioned not eating and drinking inside the shul. Now, here's the thing. What would you say is the status of the chapel in Agudas Shalom, the main sanctuary in Agudas Shalom? What about the Simcha Room in Agudas Shalom? Do they have a status of basic nesses? Do they have a status of base medrash? Well, I will let everyone here give that answer. Now, I know I can see Toby probably says, well, we have in the plans over here for the new building that doesn't have a... Okay, well, we'll get to that in just a moment. Says basic nesses here, right? So let me show you the question from Rav Nachum Rabinovich. He deals with a similar question, and then I want all of you to give an answer after we're done going through this tshuva about how we should categorize our shul. Now, the eating drinking question, I don't know what our shul policy is. I mean, I assume we don't really encourage eating inside the sanctuary and the chapel in general, right? Because it creates
It's never been an issue. Well, first of all, that's not true, because on Shavuos night, they put out refreshments in the chapel.
The back of the chapel.
People are eating the whole night through in the chapel. And in the regular shul, they've never, you know, there's never been an issue about, like, if somebody brings a child and they have a little baggie of Cheerios with them or something, no one ever said, oh, they can't have that. That's never been something that's really been enforced.
Right.
But I think when initially when the sanctuary built, it should be kind of in it should be dedicated. Okay, sometimes it says eating it is allowed. Mm. So it could be like prerequisite.
Very good. So what Marina's suggesting is, you know, really our main sanctuary might be a Beis HaKnesses in spirit, but many times what people do is when they designate, when they say, I'm sure when the shul was originally made, was it Rabbi Ehrenkrantz? Who was
around when and it was made in the 1800s.
I thought we had a few buildings. Didn't we have like a few buildings?
Yes. The first one was on Grove Street.
You're talking about this building, Rabbi Kurtz?
Yeah, the current one.
Yes, so it was Rabbi Ehrenkrantz.
So I'm sure that Rabbi Ehrenkrantz, when he had the sanctuary built, he had in mind that it was established as a Beis Medrash, not as a Beis HaKnesses. I can't guarantee that. But what Marina is suggesting is many people will stipulate that this is a Beis Medrash. Do you have a bunch of yeshiva bachrim who are sitting down learning Gemara all day in there? No, not really. But the idea is that you want to use it for multiple functions, not just strictly for davening. So that would halachically, if you stipulate at the beginning, I'm using it for different purposes, then you might be able to get away with a few functions. However, that doesn't mean you could get away with anything you want to do. For instance, what about Purim revelry? What if we want to have a crazy Purim celebration inside the sanctuary? Now, the beauty of this is that I've never seen any of this at the shul. So I guess you could tell me what happens afterwards if I overstep my bounds. But when I grew up and I was in Darche in Far Rockaway, so it's like the craziest scene. So you have all these yeshiva guys in high school and a little bit above in Beis Medrash. They're all getting drunk. And so the Beis Medrash, it's kind of like the chapel where but there's no women's section on the bottom. There's only the women's section in the balcony, but it's almost like a separate room, even more so than at our shul. Just like kind of like these windows open enough that, you know, almost like if someone attacks the battlements, you could spill out boiling oil to stop them. Not really. They never tried that. But essentially, you have all these like drunk guys who are in the Beis Medrash. They're dancing around circles and doing all sorts, depending on how drunk you are, doing crazier things. And then the women, what are the women doing? So the women, they get escorted by security up to the second floor balcony where they just watch all the men being crazy and jumping on top of each other and regurgitating as they do whatever they do. And that was kind of the scene that I remember when I went to yeshiva for Purim. So the question is something like that permissible even inside a Beis Medrash, which is supposed to be a little bit more multi-purpose? Where do we draw the line, even if according to what Marina's suggesting, we stipulate everything as a Beis Medrash? So let's look at the Tshuva. We're on, it's the first page in the Tshuva for those who are following inside. As usual, you could follow along inside, or you could just listen to me as I read and translate it. So here's the question, the Shela. They say, Vershubo ani mishamish karav, aim of neshel Beis Knesses. So I've never been to Bicultural, but can anyone tell me, do they have like an official like room that's the shul in the school?
Same yes.
Yeah,
Phyllis? Yes. Yes.
Okay. So imagine, you know, this is like the guy who's sending the question here. He's like the Rabbi Tzvi Bernstein of the school. That's what I'm gathering here. So imagine he sends a question to whoever our postdoc is. And he says, I'm like the rabbi of the school. And we have this room which is designated as, for lack of a better term, the shul in the school. We took a multi-purpose room and we designated it as a shul inside our school for davening. We even like put a nice sign over it that says Beis HaKnesses on top of it. Our own kosher sefer Torah. And there's constantly an Aron Kodesh. There's an ark with Sifrei Torah inside. So I have two questions. Ha'im l'makom yesh kedushas Beis HaKnesses. Number one, does this room have a status of a Beis HaKnesses now that we've established to always use it day in, day out for minyanim? Question number two, ha'im mutter la'aruch beis HaKnesses es mesibas ha'purim shel tamidim? Are we allowed to have a Purim party inside this room? Medubar bebanim banos yachdov. The boys and girls will be together. And there will be plays, dances, and costume contests, all the revelry that you can imagine when it comes to Purim. Kind of like what I described. So he asks, is this mutter to do in this room? Is this A, a Beis HaKnesses? And even if it's not a Beis HaKnesses, are these activities permissible to do in this room? Now, the broader question that I want us to think about here isn't just simply a narrow inquiry of, is it mutter to have a Purim party inside a Beis HaKnesses? But what I think part of this tshuva should be telling us is, how should someone be celebrating Purim as well? That's something for us to think about, because Purim has a very joyous, uplifting, and untamed nature to it, depending on what communities and places you find yourself in. So where do we draw the line between joyous celebration and complete frivolity, right? So I just wanted to read to you something. Anyone recognize this book over here?
Too small, can't see it.
It's called the Ezra's Torah Luach.
Oh,
this is every Gabbai and Rabbi's Bible, basically, when it comes to Minyan. You want to know, are we saying a Kel Mali this Shabbos? You want to know, are we inserting Al Anis, whatever? It's all in here. This is what everyone follows. So the Ezra's Torah Luach, usually you look up just for Zmanim. You look up for technical information like I described. Oh, you know, what day is the Tainis Bechoros going to take place this year? You look it up in here. So it's a step-by-step guide. But every now and then, they slip in a little bit of commentary.
Does it change every year?
Yes. This is, as you can see, it's...
I've never heard of it.
5781. I know it's backwards. But you get a new one each and every year. So...
Who puts it together?
This organization called Ezra's Torah Luach. It's the Ezra's Torah, the Human Side of Torah Philanthropy Foundation. And basically, like every 2 seconds in a book, whenever it's someone's yard site, they say, by the way, a good place to donate your most or your machetzis a shekel is to our organization. So they do a lot of that.
Fundraising.
But so I used to gloss over what was written here, but then every now and then they have a little bit of like commentary in here, which is great. So I'll read to you briefly what I read here about Purim coming up. So they quoted the name of Rav Henkin in America, the Rav Henkin who's here in America. He writes about banging during Haman on Purim. I quote, "Because of the noise that is made after the mention of Haman, many people do not hear the words and thus fail to perform a biblical Midivrei Kabbalah commandment. Those who initiated this custom of banging during Haman, of making noise at the mention of Haman's name, had the pure intentions of performing the mitzvah in a superior fashion. But today, the interest is only in wanton levity and unruly conduct that is always prohibited." So basically, what he writes over here is that what started off as a very tame practice, there's banging during Haman just to be mekayim, to fill the mitzvah of blotting out the memory of Amalek, because Haman was a descendant of Amalek, turned into a very frivolous practice that they are claiming is not appropriate inside the shul. In fact, by the way, they write, "The Sfarnim have a custom of making noise only at the mention of Haman during the singing of Shoshanis Yaakov, after the reading of the Megillah is already over." They don't. I've never been to a Sephardi reading. Anyone here been to a Sephardi reading ever? Apparently, purportedly, Sephardim don't bang during Haman. They just bang after Megillah reading is over. That way, they don't miss a word and lose the mitzvah.
Rabbi Kurtz, here we're used to repeating the word Haman.
That's what most people do, right? But I'll just finish what he's saying. So this is a fitting custom that should be universally adopted. Now, that's very radical. This is written by very traditional people. So if they're telling the Ashkenazim to adopt the Sephardic custom, you best bet that there must be an extreme case. But why do I bring this up, other than it being very humoring to find in Ezra's Torah Luach? I guess if we're more familiar with the book, you'll understand why I'm humored that they threw that in there. It's usually like very dry stuff. So it's that, where do we draw the line between the fun celebration of Purim and inappropriate frivolity? You know, it's, I don't know. But this tshuva, this question really gets to the depth. It gets to the heart of the matter. So let me read through the tshuva a little bit. Pasuk b'Shulchan Aruch, we're looking
at... Rabbi, does the tshuva mention behavior on Simchas Torah?
It does not. But if you are interested, I wrote an article about dancing on Simchas Torah right before the Simchas Torah. And did I give the shear to this group back then? Does anyone remember? Yeah. I definitely, yes, I think I did. So it's recorded on YU Torah. I wrote an article for Torah Musings about it, and I gave it at the shul under the tent as well, between Mincha and Mar. So if you want that info, I could send it over. Dancing at Simchas Torah.
Did you deal with drinking on Simchas Torah?
No, yeah, I didn't. Maybe I'll be next year's shear. Chare Sheminu Kekenem, then that'll be our problem, right?
Ad lo yada only applies to Purim, right?
Trying to get me to go on record here, right?
But
Adlo yada is a mitzvah on Purim. But,
and what about Shabbos? When we have bar mitzvahs, there's a lot of dancing going on sometimes.
Yes.
Okay, great. This is a whole separate shiur, which I'm happy to review with everyone because I guess Yom Tov coming up, it's important. But if anyone reminds me, I will send you I'll send you my article and I'll send you the YU Torah link. I think basically, you know, many months ago when it was around Simchas Torah time, we actually did it. But basically it comes down to there's a general prohibition of dancing. Rabbinically, and then how can we dance in Simchas Torah, which is also an age-old custom? So maybe the dancing we do today is not real dancing, like what we actually did. You know, you shuffle around, that's okay, but jumping over chairs and doing acrobatics, that might be problematic. There's a lot more to the shear there. But anyway, let's get into the tshuva. All right. Pasuk b'Shulchan Aruch, Rechava shel Ir af al pi shemispalim b'taniyos ein ba mishum kedusha. So we learn in the Gemara Maseches Tainus, I guess when we're done with Makos on Thursday night, we can move on to Tainus. So in the Gemara and Tainus tells us that during the great fast days, no rain was coming down. They would gather in the plaza of the city and they would have a huge outdoor minyan. Even before COVID was a thing, they were having outdoor minyanim. And so the question is, this big outdoor place, they set up a tent, they set up a whole to-do, right? Like what we did with our parking lot. Does the parking lot now have a Kedusha space at Knesset? Does it have the sanctity of a shul now, of a synagogue? No, it doesn't. It was temporary. So too, when let's say we have a Shiva mini at someone's house. Imagine that. Imagine every time there's a Shiva mini at someone's house. Great. Now your shul is a base at Knesset. Think of all the things you can't do in the privacy of your own home now. No, that's not true. A temporary minion somewhere doesn't imbue Kedusha space Knesset, that doesn't make something into a sanctuary. Hasochim beis mispalim bo, if you rent a place, also, ein lo din beis Knesset, it doesn't become a shul. Din ze mofia gamba levush el shesham anutza murchav hu adin batim shesochim osan lispal behem, etc., etc. Skip down to where I underline the Aruch HaShulchan for those who are inside. So we know at this point, it's clear from the Shulchan Aruch, that if there's a temporary place that one davens in or one makes a minyan in, it does not have the status of a synagogue. So our parking lot, even though we had two tents out there during the high holidays, the parking lot is not considered the same as being in the chapel or being inside our sanctuary. On top of that, though, the Aruch HaShulchan gives a little bit of a distinction that's important to keep in mind. Baruch HaShulchan, Medayik B'Loshon Rechab B'Shulchan Aruch, Sha'al Bayis Muskar Kosav, while a place that one rents to hold minyanim may not have the status of a beis hakneses, when it came to a outdoor place, a plaza, it says ein bo kedusha. What do you think is the difference between when the Shulchan Aruch in one place says that the plaza, which was used for a temporary minyan, doesn't have a status of holiness, whereas a temporary place that you rented out a room to host minyanim in there, it doesn't have a status of a beis hakneses. What do you think is the distinction between that?
Mezuzah?
The implication, Phyllis?
No, I was thinking about a mezuzah on the door or Sifrei Torah.
Well, actually, you know, it's an interesting halakha that you don't need a mezuzah on a shul technically. Right. We do that anyway, but right. You don't need one.
Permanent Sifrei Torah.
Okay, so there are laws about transferring Sifrei Torah. That is true. The distinction that he says is that maybe some place doesn't have a status of a beis hakneses. It might not be a shul, but at least it still has some kedusha in it. So let's say we rented out, I don't know, you know, we had to close down a good shalom completely for construction. And then we rented out the public school a block down on Strawberry Hill Avenue. And we hosted Miguel there for a while. So what would that public school now, maybe it imbues a certain level of Kedusha into that place that was rented out. Somewhere that's rented out and you use consistently for a minyan, it still retains a certain degree of kedusha. Let's say we rent out, right? We close down good Hashem temporary. This is not happening. It's not part of construction plans, as far as I know, at least. We're keeping the shul, right? So Toby can confirm that the shul is completely is becoming open. Even more. What was that?
Open.
And we're getting even more rooms done, as far as I know. So this is not happening, but an alternate reality of a good Hashem. Imagine that we were at that Strawberry Hill public school there. So while we are renting out the room in Strawberry Hill public school, there's a certain, it's not a shul, it's not a Beit HaKnesses. You know, you can kiss your kid in there if that's what you want to do. You can eat in there, but there's a certain degree of kedusha, of sanctity that's still in there. Now this is important. Why? Because when it comes to the room inside this school that Rav Nachum Rav Moshe is getting a question about, he's going to say that when it comes to this school, it might not be a Beis HaKnesses, that room that you designated for a shul, but it still has sanctity in there. And you can't just do anything you want in that room. What do we do about this room that's become the shul of the school? Number one, he introduces the marina principle that you should first stipulate that this is not a Beis HaKnesses. You could do that. This is just a room that we happen to hold minyanim in. You know, if you go to like a sleepaway camp also, many times, there's not a lot of big auditoriums that you have at a sleepaway camp. So many times, the same room that you're using for minyanim, because it's the biggest room, is also used for the camp play. It's used for trivia night. It's used for whatever else goes on in sleepaway camps that I surprisingly am already forgetting about. I probably am repressing all the memories. That's why I'm forgetting.
An occasional lecture.
The occasional lecture, halavai, that's what we always had, right? See, the issue was when I went to camp all the time as a kid, I was always the fantasy sci-fi nerd. So I didn't like the whole culture of from the sports to being forced to sing and all that. Now you know how I was traumatized and why I don't like long davening now.
Where did you go to camp?
So I mean, there's places I went to and places I worked at, so it's a whole slew. As you know, Toby, I went to Ramamu for a little bit.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, then I never said that.
No, Daniel went there.
Oh yeah, that's why I thought
until he had to start wearing a hat on Shabbos, then he left.
Okay, that was a deal breaker. So Ramamu, Banim, Anavu, like a lot of the more, I guess.
But my grandson goes to Ramamu now.
Oh, okay. So we have a lot in common there.
Yeah.
So that was what I went to as a kid. And then after Shana Aleph in Israel, I went to Morasha one summer. I worked in Morasha. And then I worked at Mosheva for two summers. So then I got acquainted with the modern Orthodox camps. But what was I saying? Oh, yeah. So, yeah, in those camps, so they do all sorts of things in those auditoriums. They have the plays in there. They have slow shira in there. And, you know, just imagine you're a kid. You have all this pent up energy and you're being forced to sit down to just do kumbaya for 3 hours until the end of Shabbos. So, you know, that's why I don't have patience anymore, I guess. Anyway, so back to this room. The Amshich L'shtanish B'l Shar Tzarki Beis HaSefer. So you're allowed this room, the multi-purpose room, which happens to be used for minyan, you could use for other purposes. And even if you don't stipulate explicitly, it's not a Beis HaKnesses, like Marina said, it's okay. When you made this multi-purpose room, you had in mind for it to be a multi-purpose room. So Bistam, Aim Beit Sefer, Ragel, Yosmel, Ulam, Gadol, Echashbo, Orchid, Kominia, Echnasis, etc. He basically keeps making the point that we said. However, Yesh livdok etzamachitza bein habanu lubanosuchin esarona kosher abima. So one way to tell if something is a shul or if something is a multi-purpose room, he says, it doesn't always work, because you'll see if our chapel doesn't actually work. But if you look at the mechitzas, if the mechitzas are in an established place that don't get moved around, then you know that this is an established shul. Many times the litmus test for knowing whether something's a multi-purpose room or whether something is a shul is if the mechitza is, I don't know, it has to be bolted down into the ground, but if it's like an established mechitza versus like a flimsy little thing down the middle that you can move easily. Now, our mechitzas in the chapel are not flimsy things down the middle, but, you know,
but they do get moved. But they are movable.
Right. They're deliberately movable.
Yeah.
So, you know, the funny thing is this litmus test probably doesn't work in a more Haredi community where, you know, the mechitzas are always supposed to be in place even for recreational functions. The men and women are supposed to be separate. So this litmus test, you can see it's a little bit of modern orthodoxy peeking out over here. This only works in a more modern orthodox community where we move the mechitza for everything other than davening. But he says, are they movable or are they not? That's a good way to figure them out. He says afterwards, okay, let's go to the next paragraph. Now, one other thing to keep in mind, by the way, is that he asked, can I have this party between boys and girls together? Is that appropriate? So what do you think he's going to answer? I thought he was modern Orthodox. No?
No.
Okay. Well, I guess even the modern Orthodox rabbis have their limits. So we'll see that soon. But I mean, like a lot of people in the B'nai Akiva world, they actually looked up to him. He passed away very recently. But they looked up to him as, I think, as one of the big scholars, one of their leaders. But it's always funny to see the dissonance between the rabbi and then, you know, the people who are asking the questions as well. I guess they listened to him on the matters they wanted to listen to him on. Anyway, Baram, we're in the second to last paragraph in his tshuva on page 26. Ein leros b'chol ha-shimush ma-ragiyam sh'ulam be-sever shum davar shel b'zayin chas v'shalom. You can do different things in this room. You can, you know, you can have an assembly in this room. But you can't do anything that would, God forbid, constitute a bizayon, a disgrace. So av chagigas Purim. So where does that leave us when it comes to Purim revelry? So he says, you know, you want to have the Purim spiel. You know, it might not be strictly a mitzvah, but it's a reka shel mitzvah. There's a background of mitzvah. Why are we celebrating this? Because it's connected to a mitzvah of the holiday. There's a number of mitzvahs we do on Purim, right? We have shalach manos, we have the Megillah, we have matanos lev yonim, we got the sudas, the meal of Purim. There's no mitzvah that says thou shalt dress up on Purim, thou shalt have a Purim play on Purim. So they're not strictly mitzvahs, but they're associated with the mitzvah. So he says, he equivocates, maybe it's not so bad. Then, now here's an important thing that I personally, I think it's easily achievable and should be done. That even if a shul is a multi-purpose room, at very least, if there's an Aron Kodesh in the room, if you're going to use the room for a secular purpose, which is an appropriate purpose, not a disgraceful purpose, but a purpose other than something that's religious, then what you do is you put an extra covering in front of the Aron. So you have it's closed, you have the curtain, and then you take a mechitza or you take something else and you cover the Aron with that, just to create an extra layer of separation, he recommends. So again, I don't know what our customs are over here. That's not for me to determine, but that is something that many places do.
But that's not the parochet, right?
It's an addition to the parochas. So the parochas is closed, the curtain is closed, and then there's another layer. So you kind of have like three layers at that point, just to show another level of separation. That's something that he recommends. And then finally, in the last paragraph, he says, "Ashilri kunim b'purim." When it comes to the dancing on Purim, is it mutter to dance inside the shul? Right? We asked a little bit about dancing. Well, he says, if we're talking about boys and girls dancing together, b'chol makom u'b'chol zman. So this is absolutely prohibited in any place at any time. The imarikunim heim benifra, but if it's separate dancing, ain't sibul asor. But if they're separate, no reason to say it's prohibited. So, you know, here you have, he's, I wish we did a few chuas before and to show you how liberal he is on other issues, just so you could appreciate this in terms of on conversion standards and actually on other women's issues as well. But when it comes to the whole idea of mixed and separate dancing, he holds the line. This could have been said by the same thing by Ramosha Feinstein as well. So I guess you could only go so far.
Is so it separate says, in the same room, or could does he mean separate in different rooms?
Just no. So they could be in the same. I think, you know, that's a good question. I think they're in the same room, but they would be, you know, I don't know if they're, you know, that's a good question. Like, you know, should, are we talking about separate rooms, or maybe it's the same room, but they're on separate sides of the room, or maybe there needs to be a mechitza separating them as well, right? Yeah. I mean, you know, at what point do you draw the line over there? So, you know, he doesn't really elaborate on that so much. He has a separate tshuva, which if you're so interested by his side, we can look at later on where, let's see, it's in the table of contents over here. The tshuva is called Ikronos Hafronos Nashim Ugvarim Bechevra Ubiurim, a whole tshuva on principles of separating women and men at gatherings and events. Which is it's actually a longer tshuva. It's about 10 pages. So I don't know if that could take us quite a few sessions. I don't know if we're going to go through all that. I don't know if everyone wants to hear what he has to say on all of it either. So I'll leave that to your imagination. Anyway, so that is the conclusion of this tshuva, that basically when it comes to a multi-purpose room that's used as a shul, it may not be a Beis HaKnesses, but it has kedusha, there's sanctity. And therefore, we need to be concerned for the dignity of the Torahs that are in there and for the dignity of a room which is used for minyanim, that is used for holy purposes. So even if one is allowed to put on a skit in that room, one is allowed to have an assembly in that room, one's allowed to have a trivia night or a bingo night in that room, so then one would still need to make sure that they're still respecting the dignity of that room. Now, you know, I haven't been to one of our famed bingo nights yet, but I assume it's inherently a dignified event, right? We all come in our finest wares and our jewelry and on, you know, our monocles and whatever we come in, and we put down our money to bet. I'm not sure actually if that part's true.
Or how about a mixed choir in the shul where the Sefer Torah are?
Well, you have to ask yourself if a mixed choir is okay, and that's a whole tshuva of the Sridei Eish. Where he talks about a co-ed choir, and he gives a few bases saying that it might be okay halachically. So his question was, he got asked a question by a youth group back, I think it was in Germany, and the youth group asked, it was kind of like a Bnei Akiva youth group or something, or NC Swy, something similar to that. The boys and girls sing Zmiros together, but there's Kol Isha, men can't hear women sing, so how do we circumvent that? So he has a whole long tshuva about that, and he gives a few rationales. One of them is Trei Kalei Lo Mishtamai, that if you have more than one voice sing at the same time, you can't focus on one particular voice.
Right.
So that way, you're not over Kolisha. That's a whole other shear. Toby.
This is also, my question is probably another whole shear, but how would, you know, those who feel, you know, like this rabbi who feels strongly about the separation of the sexes for different things, how does he deal, or how would he deal with co-ed Zoom classes? Is there any issue? I mean, we're all on here together, men, women. Would that be an issue, or it's only if you're physically in the same place?
Interesting question.
Is the issue seeing each other, hearing each other, or just the actual physical proximity?
So I think, I haven't looked up pictures, but I think you'll probably find classes of him talking to men and women in person. He was okay with that. His issue here is that dancing is inherently a more frivolous activity. So when you have men and women dancing together, that's something that's more likely to lead to frivolity than men
dancing
and women together
or dancing together. Dancing together or dancing in the same room?
Both. I mean, so again,
wouldn't he have a problem with, let's say, if it's a social thing, even without dancing? to be mixed.
So you know what? If we really want to get to the bottom of it, that's this whole tshuva over there, which I haven't gone through in detail yet. But you know, where his tshuva comes up? I gave a class. I think I've shared this before. So my first year, I spent 2 years as a rabbinic intern at Young Israel Plainview. My first year there, my first Shabbos on the job was my Shabbos Sheva Brachos. I had just got married that week. So My family comes from a little bit more of a yeshivish background. Marissa's family comes from a more modern Orthodox background. And so one of the things that came up when they were planning seating at the wedding was that many people from my side wanted separate seating. So we had a hybrid wedding. There were mixed tables and there were separate tables to accommodate. So I'm like, oh, you know what? That's a fun shear to give a fun topic to give a shear on. So I went through poskim from Rav Moshe Sternbach to Rav Nachum Rabinovich and everything in between on different opinions on separate seating.
I understand.
Did you go to the OU rabbis? Did you? I mean, that's very narrow in between there.
Well, I understand. So, back in the day,
yes,
that Rav Feinstein, you know, sat at mixed tables at weddings.
Yeah. They censored these things out of the art scroll book.
Well, that's the thing, because as Toby was talking about this education thing, I kept thinking about Hillary Clinton's picture being removed from the news.
Let me show you.
When Bin Laden was.
A bunch of people in our community has Michael Feldstein lent it to me, but Hyman Schaefer has it as well. All of our, the people in our community you'd expect would have this habit. This is written by Mark Shapiro. It's called Changing the Immutable. It's an entire book on censorship, on Jewish censorship. And so you bring up the Hillary Clinton thing, right?
Right. It's just so absurd.
To censorship in Judaism, that you see, he has the two photos of one in the situation with Osama bin Laden. And I don't know if you can see it well here. In one picture, Hillary Clinton's in there. The other picture is gone.
What did they do with Maggie Thatcher and Golda Meir and, Kamala Harris? And
So I remember there was a joke that went around after Trump won not the 2020 election.
2016.
Yeah. No, was it? 2016 election. After he won the 2016 election. So they said all the yeshivish papers were relieved because they didn't know what they were going to do if they couldn't print a picture of the president for the next 4 years of Hillary Clinton.
It's going to happen someday.
Right. Well, that's why actually if you look in the Siddur, RCA Sidurim, they actually have an option not just for Nasi, but for a female president as well in the new RCA Sidurim, because they anticipate that it was going to happen. I think it was printed actually during the election season. They thought Hillary was going to win, so they made sure to put that in the Siddur. Okay. I'm not sure if they thought or if they were, it was.
You can't censor out half the population.
I think that would be a very good book for your Thursday morning class.
Oh, okay. I'm open to doing that. I'm in the middle. I'll just share with you before we conclude. I'm in the middle of putting together a class on censorship, basically on censorship in Jewish education. The question is, if I can, bring someone closer to observance, or I could bring a kid or an adult and inspire them to be more involved in Jewish practice, but I have to censor something that they might find offensive. Is it okay to censor something or to tell a white lie or sugarcoat something in the effort of getting someone to be more happy? You know, for instance, like, let's say we're learning Gemara and there's a section there that talks about, someone selling off his daughter to a man. So someone with modern sensibilities would be like, that's sexist, that's terrible. So do I skip that so people don't get offended by it? So I think it's a very fascinating question in the Jewish world and then with cancel culture going around. So I've been using this book to look up some of the sources. It's been very helpful. And well, Toby, maybe that'll be our book after Rav Lichtenstein. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. We can put that suggestion in there. Okay. There is one other tshuva in here, but I leave it for your reading. Basically, he talks about cross-dressing and he concludes in the cross-dressing tshuva that if children want to dress up as different characters and it happens to be a different gender, that's fine, but one shouldn't encourage kids who are bar and bat mitzvah and older to cross-dress. Now, what's wrong with cross-dressing? Well, if you're in our Thursday night Makos class many weeks from now, that'll come up in the Gemara about how there's a prohibition in the Torah of cross-dressing. And the question is it literally only a prohibition of cross-dressing, or according to the Rabbanim, cross-dressing is just one example. One actually is not supposed to do things that resemble what the other gender does. So back in the day, men were not supposed to gaze in the mirror because it was known as a thing for women to do, that women practice looking in the mirror a lot to groom themselves. But for a man to groom himself and look in the mirror for a while was considered feminine. So one understanding is that any practice that resembles that of the other gender, someone is not supposed to be taking on. So certainly when it comes to cross-dressing on Purim, the question is, can we say, no one thinks I'm really cross-dressing for the purpose of trying to pretend to be a woman. I'm just doing it out of jest for Purim. So it's a whole other can of worms. I don't want to just throw it into our last few minutes over here, but maybe that will be a topic that we will address at some point, God willing, in the future. But anyway, I hope this is somewhat relevant to Purim. Something to think about, not just about Purim celebrations, about where do we draw the line between joyousness and frivolity, but also how we relate to our Beis HaKnesses, how we relate to our holy places and to our shul as well. These are both topics that are important for Purim and hopefully for all year round as well. Okay. Yashir Koach, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. That was good.
All right. Thank you. And wishing everyone, if I don't see you in any other class throughout the week, wishing you all a Freilich and Purim.
You too.
Everybody.
Good night.